Do aliens exist, and are they among us? Are weird creatures lurking in the darkness? Do evil entities hide in the shadows of your bedroom while you sleep? Join us as we explore all this and more on the Warped Reality Podcast.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Warped Reality Paranormal Podcast bonus episode whistleblower series with my boy, John Wright, doing his segment about the infamous David Grush. You're not going to want to miss this. You're definitely going to want to check this episode out. It's awesome. John's awesome. He put a lot of work into this. So listen to everything this man says, because he is a no BS man. He knows what he's talking about. And check it out. But before we go into that, before you see how I did that? You like that? Before we go into that, let's warm you up with a little bit of Edgegrave Dave doing an awesome, horrible review on the horror movie, The Uninvited. Let's check it out.
Horrible reviews with Edgegrave Dave.
Hey guys, Edgegrave Dave here, and I've just come to terms with the fact that the boneyard, that is my own brain, uninvited a memory and simply kicked it right out of the cemetery gates, creating an unmarked grave. But now, creep 16 years later, the shovel is handed to me by our very own Ghost Joe, where my podcast mate, special shout out, John Wright of the Right Headspace, cordially invited the memory back and made the grave whole again. Because what he cordially invited me to was 2009's The Uninvited, which we're going to get into right now. Here we go. So it's time to make this right with the invite. Here it is. Edgegrave warning, spoiler alert. 2009 was quite the year in this time period for horror. It is part of the decade where remakes became quite prevalent, actually. We had some very interesting Asian remakes done in American fashion and style, from the Ring films to The Grudge, and now we had The Uninvited, which is actually a South Korean film, A Tale of Two Sisters. 2009 brought some very interesting remakes, like The Last House on the Left, My Bloody Valentine 3D, which we recently discussed here, and the Friday the 13th remake. So this was really running strong. It seems like Hollywood was trying to make what was once old new again. And I must say, this movie is new to me once again, as I actually own the movie when Ghost Joe asked me about this. It appears that this is one of my wife's favorite movies, and as you can imagine, we're pretty stocked up with the films here. And so, yeah, I kind of forgot that we had it. But I brought it out, and it was great seeing it on the format of Blu-ray, because I did, in fact, check out some of the special features. And that is one of my favorite features of physical media. You can dive just a little bit deeper sometimes. The cast of characters for this one was pretty stoked. We had Elizabeth Banks, a new girlfriend of a father who recently lost his poor wife that had cancer in a fire. He's played by David Strathairn. His name is Steven. We have Emily Browning, the main character. Her name is Anna in the film, and she just came out of a mental hospital dealing with all of this while her poor mother died in the fire. And we have her sister, played by Arielle Cabell, Alex, who also lost their poor cancer-ridden mother in the fire. And they're all dealing with this. And you know what they're also all dealing with? They've all been in remakes one way or another. The very talented Emily Browning, she was in that awesome Jim Carrey film, Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events, which later became a Netflix show. Her sister Alex, played by Arielle Cabell, she was in the 90210 remake. Yeah, I did watch the 90210 remake, a remake of Beverly Hills 90210, that is. And then we have Elizabeth Banks. She was remake Rita Repulsa in that 2017 Power Rangers movie. And then that leaves the dad, David Strathairn, which was in the 2014 Godzilla remake. How about that? In addition, it is also worth mentioning that Emily Browning has been a mental patient of some type in three movies. In the movie God Help the Girl, this movie, and Sucker Punch. Damn. Holy hospital, Batman. Sucker Punch was some movie. But re-inviting us back to this movie, I must admit, A Tale of Two Sisters is a film that I've never seen. And when I popped open that Blu-ray disc and saw that PG-13 rating slapped on there, I was a little concerned. Is this going to be as dark and as horrifying as the integral heart that is a lot of these OG Asian films? Make no mistake about it. Just because it's PG-13 and it might cut out some of the gore, violence, and language, PG-13 does keep that integral horror element in this case. Where the movie really shines is the very emotional acting by Emily Browning. I have to say that the cast of characters, for the most part, were all very impressive. No disrespect to the actor David Strathairn. I thought that for the character that he was, that it was good, but he was a little bit more dry than the other characters. But in a way, he's a little bit more in the dark than the other three, which is Rachel, the girlfriend that moved in to be with him, and the two sisters. You could just feel the emotion oozing right out of Anna every single time. Every single scene that she's in, you just have no choice but to care about her. And when she gets in and she realizes that her father's life has changed, and Elizabeth Banks' character is sort of conniving and maneuvering to be part of his life, she could also just tell the whole story with her eyes. You can feel a sort of evil presence behind the Americana kind of apple pie way that she kind of looks while she's cooking dinner and making sure that everybody's comfortable, and she wants to have a party for when she comes back. But her sister also, I love the opposite acting, where Anna, on one hand, is very serious. She has a lot of trepidation about her actions. And then her sister, Alex, is sarcastic, like this party girl. It's like both of those energies have a symmetry that play off of each other. And playing with the audience, that symmetry that you're sort of in the eyes of this girl, Anna, making sure that everything is whole once again, you know that something ain't right. Because every couple of scenes, there is a traumatic experience that manifests itself where she is starting to see her mother. She's seeing it in a very creepy, kind of zombified, Evil Dead way. She's trying to tell her something. And then there's other people that she's starting to see. She's starting to see these little dead children. And she's becoming very afraid. Reality is blurred a little bit. This is done sometimes in horror films. I do like the pacing of the movie because you really get to stick with her. Being in the mental hospital, the movie does open up with a terrible nightmare that she has where she is trying to run to her mother. She has this bell and she rings for it every time that she needs help, drink, food, or being in care. And when the fire engulfs her, I mean, the trauma of this must have been such a shock to her whole system that she was sent away. I am not going to tell you the exact reason why she was sent away. All that you know is that she's broken from the very start of the film. And being broken with this beautiful scenic backdrop of Maine, you have this beautiful house in the day with the lake and they go swimming in there. And then it can be very scary and lonely at night. It's such an excellent transition. I really like the music in this movie. It kind of has reminiscent of Hellraiser. It just really engulfs you and it paints the sadness that you're supposed to be feeling for this girl. What really drives this movie is the mystery aspect of it. That's something that I really like about it. You are very much invested in unraveling clues as to why she was put away in the mental hospital, as to what's going to happen with her father. It's a very sad situation where her and her sister are so upset and disgusted that after just so many months, their father has moved on with this evil woman that has moved in. And apparently, the picture is painted that she might have done something like this before. And while they're giving you clues, you're getting a little bit of jump scares that are happening. But the jump scares don't really last long enough where you're really scared. Again, this is PG-13. If anything, it really does point to more questions. And I do have to say that as a whole, this movie does a very good job to answer those questions. Of course, the horror maniac that I am, when those more frightening scenes happen, for example, there's a head of a dead child that's in a garbage bag. You see the mother crawling in her room and that disgusting zombified hand is coming up and she's pointing, murder! You just want to see more of that stuff. And then maybe it's just me or some of us out there. You just understand right then and there why it's PG-13 and not rated R, but you can't go in thinking about it that way. I always go in very clean. But of course, the more in me wanted more of that stuff, but that's okay. And with those questions answered, you get one hell of a shocking, twisted ending that, you thought I was going to do it, weren't you? No, I am not going to give that away. If you're interested, go ahead and check that out for yourself because it's something that you really won't expect. And from what I hear, A Tale of Two Sisters did something very, very similar. But being the crazy grave-digging maniac that I am, there were just two things that I just could not get past. A plot hole, if you will, that of course did show up on the internet. But when I saw this happen, I did double check to make sure that what I saw was true, and it was. Again, not a really big deal. These things do happen. But I did notice that when they were talking about the Wright children, oddly enough, Wright spelled the same way as my buddy John Wright. Thank you very much once again for this movie, sir. It said that they were murdered in 1986, right on the tombstone. When they find the news article, Alex clearly says that it's 1996. I paused the movie. I went back. I put closed captioning on, and I'm like, damn, this is 1996. I also saw the driver's license of Rachel, which is Elizabeth Banks' character, and the age that she was, it would have only made sense that this was 1996 that these children were murdered. But alas, as I said, the tombstone's 1986. Another thing, not really a big deal, the father is an author, and his name is spelled Stephen, S-T-E-V-E-N. In the credits, lo and behold, it's Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can't really crucify movies like this for doing things like that. I just find it funny. Maybe just a little bit more care in the editing box, in the editing room. I'm going to go ahead and rate this one about a 3 to 3.5 out of 5 graves. I do think that the emotional acting and the music was a very good driver that keeps you vested in the story. I do think that the action kid in me wanted a little bit more of that. And I just love when they do scenes that try to frighten you. And I like to see, you know, graphically where they're going to go. But it's not that kind of movie. And you're more vested and interested in the story than those types of things. It all very well works together as a well-balanced story. And I do invite you to check out The Uninvited. I think you're going to enjoy this one. Back to you, Ghost Joe, and everybody. Have a great night. Bye.
Thank you, Edgegrave, for your awesome, awesome review. As always, thank you so much, buddy. But now we're going to go on to our boy, John Wright, and his whistleblower series of David Grush. Let's get it.
Good evening. You are entering a dimension where up is down, good is evil, and day is night. You've just made a wrong turn into the right headspace.
Welcome back, everybody. Thanks, Joe. Today's segment is going to be a continuation of the series that I'm doing on whistleblowers. Today's happened to deal with David Grush. So I'm going to kind of jump in because at some point my wife is downstairs trying to operate the DVD player. I may have to pause and run down and show her how to work that, but we'll see what happens. We'll deal with that when the time comes. Now, when I went and I started looking for information on David Grush, unfortunately, there's really not a whole lot out there that you can find. There are some things you can discover, but unfortunately, some of the stuff just doesn't get very specific. Like, for example, I was able to find his date of birth. Well, actually, let me correct that statement. I was able to find his year of birth, but there is no specific date of birth. So he was born in 1987. If you're like me, then the first time that you heard this guy's name, it was because of the interview that he had done with Russ Coulthart. And this was back in June of 2023. Some information as far as background that I was able to dig up was he is a member of or was a member of the U.S. Air Force. I was able to find out where he worked as a intelligence agent. I was able to find out, just like some other basic information, that he was a liaison for the the UAP task force. You can find like information about his mom's name. You can find his brother's name. I was unable to find any information in regards to his education, though. While he was in the Air Force, he worked for what is called the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, or if you hear of the NGA, that's typically what the acronym is going to stand for. He was also a member of what they refer to as the National Reconnaissance Office. Now, the first question that may come to mind is, what is the NGA? So when you look it up online, it is a combat support group that is responsible for collecting and analyzing geospatial intelligence. It identifies physical locations, distribution of people, and I put in quotes, friends and foes within that area, geographic features, any man-made features that can be found in those locations. What is the NRO? Is a group within the DoD that designs, builds, launches, and operates satellites. They create the systems that are going to be used to gather information which will be shared with other intelligence groups, such as the NGA. So what you're looking at here is his information is with the NGA, and the NRO is going to be analyzing physical features, things along that line that are pulled by any of these satellites that we have launched into space. Now, we fast forward to June 5th, 2023. There's an article that was written by Leslie Keene and Ralph Blumenthal, and it was published by The Debrief. Now, the name Keene and Blumenthal should sound familiar to you because these are also the people that wrote the article that appeared in the New York Times back in 2017 that was based on the whole Luis Elizondo thing. Now, as far as what's The Debrief? The Debrief is actually a publication that was created by a gentleman called Micah Hanks. Micah Hanks has a number of different podcasts. I actually listened to two of his podcasts, like what he does, love how he does it, and usually has a really good insight on the history and how things are connected to one another. In any case, so The Debrief is Micah Hanks, and he has a handful of other people who specialize in other things, like whether it be science or space-based, that kind of stuff. And bottom line is they all have an interest in science, UFOs, and so on. Now, as far as Keene and Blumenthal are concerned, people will ask, well, why didn't they go with one of the older legacy sort of publications like a New York Times like they did the last time? One of the things that both reporters did was they came out or they had produced statements to different publications, and they had said that the Washington Post was interested in publishing the article, but Washington Post wanted more time in order to vet the sources, which, to be honest with you, after the fiasco with the 2017 article and how things were left out and how they changed some things, stuff like that, I'll be honest, if I'm the Washington Post, I'm probably taking my time with this too, because I want to make sure that I'm not going to publish some tinfoil hat kind of stuff that's going to wind up, in the most likely scenario, going to wind up with me losing subscribers or people losing interest in my periodical. So according to Blumenthal and Keene, they chose to go with a Debrief because some of the information that was connected to the story that they were doing had gotten out there, and they were afraid that they were going to lose the story, that they didn't have enough time to actually hold off and wait for the Washington Post to vet all the sources. So I look at this and I go, you know what? That's understandable. I can understand why they would want to do this. A few days after the article is published, so this is somewhere around June 11th, Grush will do a sit-down interview with Russ Coulthart on News Nation. If you want to view the interview, it's easy to find on YouTube. Just make sure that when you do this, that it's a copy of the full interview, which should be somewhere around 50 to 55 minutes long. There are other ones where they kind of do bits and pieces of the segment. I'm telling you right now, if you're going to watch it, you want to watch the whole video. I'll be honest with this segment. If I wanted to, I could probably spend, I promise you, Joe, I'm not going to do that. I could probably spend probably close to an hour just going through and analyzing the video. But instead of doing that, I'm going to kind of stick to a few major points. The interview begins with Grush talking about what we are seeing and that it is not extraterrestrial. It's from here, just from a different dimension. Now, you're going to hear me do this throughout this whole interview. I have issues with some of the things that he says, and maybe not what he says, but maybe sometimes with the way that he goes about saying it. He uses the term NHI throughout the interview. NHI stands for non-human intelligence. the term extraterrestrial is used several times, as well as the term exotic. He continues to hint at things being alien, but in most of the cases, he just won't come out and say that it's alien. So if at this point, you should be able to like cue the meme in your head, the one with Giorgio Zoulakis, where he's got the crazy hair and all that stuff. And he says, it's not aliens. Oh, I'm not saying it's aliens, but that's what I got going off in my head right now. Then as he goes through the interview, he repeats, based on the theory, and he just keeps saying, oh, well, based on the theory, based on the theory. First thing that I said was, what theory? Like, what are you talking about? What theory? Whose theory? Is this your theory? Is this a theory that somebody else came up with? And he never really specifies that. Coulthart asks, so you're absolutely sure that the materials the craft are made of are clearly not of this earth. To which Grush explains, they are sophisticatedly engineered and not by human beings. Again, if they're not made by human beings, who are they made by? I'm not saying it's aliens, but anyway. All right, so another issue. Coulthard follows this up with, how long has the government been covering this up? Grush claims it has been 90 years and talks about the supposed crash in Magenta, Italy. If you are not familiar, I'll give you a short version of the myth. The original story of the Italian crash, to my recollection, was part of the MJ-12 papers. I'm wondering whether or not I should do a whole entire episode or a segment on the MJ-12 papers. And again, it's one of those, I just don't know if I have enough energy to do this. Anyway, in regards to the MJ papers, it was originally spotted in those. And it was just a blurb. It wasn't like, oh, this is a fact. This is all the things that occurred. It just showed up in there and it was a blurb. It's in the late 1990s that a gentleman by the name of William P. Brophy, will single-handedly create the narrative surrounding the supposed Magenta crash. Now, if you want to look this up, you can look for an article that was published by douglasjohnson.ghost.io. So it's Douglas Dean Johnson. He published this article May 1st of 2023, and the article is called Crash Story, The Morphing Fantasies of Billy Brophy About His Airman Father. Now, if you're not familiar with the MJ-12, just a quick side note here. The MJ-12 papers were a series of memos, documents that were, and I put it in quotes, quote unquote, revealed that the government was involved in cover-ups, crashes. And we now know that this is a hoax. It's pretty much a hoax. There are some things in there that, like a lot of disinformation, there's bits and pieces of truth just to kind of give it enough to make people buy into it. And it's believed at this point that Richard Doty, who I should probably do another segment on. I know a lot of people knock this guy, but I kind of look at it and go, if it wasn't for this dude, we wouldn't have the UFO mythology that we have today. Anyway, back to Brophy. So William Brophy will insert his father into a number of different UFO crashes. He'll write letters to the Flying Saucer Review, and this is a series of letters that go from March of 2003 to July of 2003 to August of 2003. All of these letters will serve to connect William J. Brophy Jr., the father of William P. Brophy, to the crash in Socorro, New Mexico. Over the course of the three letters, the story will kind of morph and change. The letters will be mentioned, will mention crashes. And they will mention them in like reverse chronological order, starting with the Socorro crash in 1950. The second and the third letters will then connect the father to the 1947 crash on the McDonald Ranch in White Sands, New Mexico, which happens to be near what they call the Trinity bomb site. Now, another side note, a lot of the stuff that Brophy came out with has basically been debunked. His brother was one of those guys that came out and debunked this. His father, unfortunately, had died prior to this. The reason why I bring this side note up is because the information regarding Brophy is going to be included in the book called Trinity, The Best Kept Secret, August, and is published August of 2023. And this was written by Jacques Vallée and Paula Harris. At this point, if you can see what I'm doing right now, I'm doing the facepalm thing. Why? Because we have people who continue to write books and write stories, put on podcasts that continue to push out false information. And it just continues to like propagate this myth that exists. Anyway, in the 2013 letters, he will make a mention of 2 7-foot-tall aliens, which died in the crash at the McDonald Ranch, and that the bodies were retrieved at some point and brought to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. In regard to the Trinity crash, William P. Brophy, the son, will mention 3 grays, which had mantis-like features. Now, don't quote me on this, but I think this, at least in my mind, is one of the first mentions in regards to mantis-like creatures, but I digress. in a letter to Filer's Files, a publication produced by retired Major George Filer, Brophy writes about speaking at the San Marino Republic. San Marino, small little country, city-state in Italy. He speaks at the San Marino Republic UFO Symposium. His main topic, the Magenta Crash from 1933. He mentions a bell-shaped craft that should sound familiar to most of you, the Nazi bell, Bell Glock, all that stuff, which crashed west of Milan. The craft was occupied by Nordic-type aliens. That should also sound familiar to you. We've heard that. I can't even tell you how many times, whether we're talking about Adamski, whether we're talking about Travis Walton or whoever else that's kind of involved in this thing. We get the Nordics all the time. Anyway, the craft was occupied by Nordic-type aliens. He mentions that Pope Pius II had learned of the crash from Mussolini himself, and that the Pope was able to pass that information along to FDR. Now, another claim is that the supposed UFO involved in the Battle of Los Angeles, which takes place in 1942, was piloted by none other than Nordic aliens, which were the same type found in the Milan crash and also in the Trinity crash. According to his story, the 1st Armored Division will capture the base at which the Magenta UFO was being held, and they will do this in April of 1945. The UFO will then be shipped to the United States. Now, you're probably asking yourself this question. Why am I going into so much detail? The reason why I mentioned this is because Grush says that there's a 90-year history and that bodies in that crashes and craft have all been captured and brought in. So I put, sound familiar? It should. Why? Because this is the same shit that's been shoveled by William P. Brophy and a man who was hounded by his brother and is having mental health issues and all these other things. And the brother says he's prone to exaggeration. This is the stuff that continues to get shoveled out there. And now we have a gentleman who has high security clearance, all these other things, which I'll get into in a little bit. That is continuing to kind of propagate this issue. Anyway, moving on. Other contradictions can be found in his telling of the, and this is going back to Brophy, because again, when something didn't fit, if something new popped up, what Brophy would do is go back and retrofit the story to include some of these new things in it. Whether we're talking about the Nordics or the Greys or things along that line. So, if you want, you can look this one up again, just as an attempt to try and save time. It's called the Baca Padilla story. You can look it up. He does his original telling, and then what happens is he will go back and retrofit it so that this way he can kind of paint his father into the story, and he can kind of bring some of the newer ideas that are out there, excuse me, into the new story. Now, later in the interview, Grush claims that he has known Sean Kirkpatrick. Now, if you don't know who Kirkpatrick is, he was the director of Arrow. He is no longer. Now, what is Arrow? It is the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office. That is the new UAP task force, if you want to call it that. Now, he claimed that he had known this guy for 8 years. And Grush states that he had reached out to Kirkpatrick and that Kirkpatrick did not follow up with him. Now, I was able to find an article, and this appears on the AP News website. The article is called "The UFO Congressional Hearing Was Insulting to U.S. Employees," a top Pentagon official says. And this was written by Newman Merchant and Tara Cobb. It was published in July of 2023. In the article, it is mentioned by Kirkpatrick that, yet, contrary to assertions made in the hearing, the central source of those allegations has refused to speak with Arrow. Well, if we go back to congressional hearing, the only person that is doing the that's making the allegations is David Grush. But what we're hearing in this article is that, well, Kirkpatrick saying Grush never contacted him. Now, I know there's a raging debate over whether or not he did or he didn't, but let's just take Kirkpatrick at his word. Maybe he didn't. So what does this all mean? Either there's a cover-up, which I don't think there is, or Grush is lying about reaching out to him, or maybe he's over exaggerating. Let's give him the benefit of the doubt. Anyway, so Kothar asks, have any humans been hurt or killed by NHI? To which Grush responds, I can't get into specifics because that would reveal classified operations. I was briefed by a few individuals on the program, that there were malevolent events like that. So the first thing that popped up to mind is, well, the individuals on this program, what the hell program are you talking about? And then I automatically jumped to the time that they're talking about here. Was it Elizondo? Is he one of the guys that's on the program that he's talking about? I don't know. Maybe we'll see. So what I found interesting was during the actual hearing, Rush will be asked almost an identical question, and he refuses to answer it. Now, some people say, oh, well, maybe he was being threatened and all this other stuff. And I'm going to give you one better. I'm going to say because, I don't know, he was under oath. If he gets caught, lying under oath, he goes to jail. So I think that's why he changes his story. Is there any evidence of killings? No, not really. There's a lot of stuff that's out there, and I've purchased a lot of books. I've read a lot of articles. One of the books that I think that does a really good job of explaining some of these things is Adam Gorightly's Saucers, Spooks, and Kooks. In it, he identifies where a lot of this idea and where a lot of these stories come from. So I would suggest to you, go out, purchase that book. Kindle, I always do paperback. I'm old school. I need a book in my hand. I can't stand Kindles. But he explains where a lot of this has come from. And my belief is that he, meaning Grush, is referring to the Dulce Base skirmish, which supposedly happened between humans and aliens. And again, there's letters, notes, things like that. I would tell you, take a look at this book because Adam does a really good job of talking about the mythos. And if I remember correctly, a lot of this stuff stems back to Richard Doty sort of setting these things up. Anyway, so what's my point here? Most of this stuff has pretty much been debunked. And I said most of it has been believed to be rumors that were started by Richard Doty. I'm making the decision. I'm gonna do a segment on Richard Doty. I just kind of have to. Anyway, continuing on with this one, Coulthard asks about agreements between the U.S. and NHI. In his response, Rush says, "I think that's a question I would like to know all the details of as well," which doesn't really answer anything. Anyway, so it continues on and he talks about the 1971 SALT conference. He makes the assertion that the conference between the U.S. and the Soviet Union was done out of, how shall I say this, both groups' awareness of the existence of NHI. And he implies that it took place because they wanted to avoid issues with the NHI. Grush uses what is referred to as Article 3 from the conference as justification for his claim. Now, Article 3 reads, "The parties undertake to notify each other immediately of unidentified objects." So the question is, why include this clause? He implies that this is done as a measure to kowtow to the NHI, that they're doing this because they want to be able to avoid nuclear disaster. Not only do they want to avoid nuclear disaster, they want to avoid drawing the ire of the NHI. Maybe this was done to avoid possible misunderstandings, which could lead to, I don't know, missile launch and an unwanted nuclear war. Or is it a possible litmus test to see if, a clandestine mission, some sort of flight, some sort of craft that we are using new technology has been spotted by the enemy? Well, if they see it, they notify us. If they notify us, we know it's not working. If we know it's not working, we could go back to the drawing board and we can fix it. Or maybe they're seeing something from somebody else and they can notify us and then we can figure out who that somebody else is, which would provide feedback on our new technology or their new technology. Anyway, side note. Another possible example of an agreement that has been brought up time and time again with aliens is the supposed meeting with Eisenhower at Edwards Air Force Base in California, which supposedly took place, I think it was 1954 and 1953. Based on the information that's come out of it, the Greys were involved. The Greys had established some sort of exchange that they would give us technology in exchange for that technology, that we, the humans, would allow them to abduct people. Now, based on this, it was, they would be allowed to abduct a certain number. Then over time, that winds up blowing up. And then other people will say, well, this was the agreement, but the Greys decided, since they were kind of in control, they would abduct whatever number of people that they wanted to. Now, is this real? So in reality, Eisenhower was in California. He was on vacation, a golfing vacation, and he was notorious. Well, I shouldn't say, he was known for having really bad teeth. The way it goes is one of his teeth had either cracked or chipped. And that is the reason why he had to do this unscheduled visit to the hospital at Edwards Air Force Base. It was to correct the dental problem that he was having at that time. Later in the interview, Coulthard asks, have people been killed to protect the secret? To which Grush answers, based on the people I've talked to, that was an ongoing concern. I've heard some really un-American things that I don't want to repeat right now. Coulthard will also ask Grush, do you have any evidence to back these claims? We get the simple no. No photos, no videos, no documents, no physical proof whatsoever. Coulthard continues. He asks Grush, do you have any kind of mental illness? To which Grush immediately responds, no, I do not. Now, I'm going to point to an Intercept article, which was done by Ken Klippenstein. And this was published back in August 9th of 2023. It says, UFO whistleblower kept security clearance after psychiatric detention. Now, high-level security clearances can be provoked or can be revoked based on psychological issues or even the result of substance abuse. The author of the article was able to locate a police report which had been filed in 2000. Well, actually, he located reports that were filed in 2014 and in 2018. The one article focuses primarily on the article that was reported in, the report that came out in 2018. So this was October 1st, 2018. Grush's wife had contacted the Loudoun County Sheriff's Office to report that Grush was drunk and suicidal. The report continues, she told him that he was an alcoholic and that he needed to get help. He replied, I've just been waiting for you to kill me. Now, the names on the report are redacted, but the address and all other pertinent information helps fill in the blanks. So even though it doesn't have his name specifically on the report, doesn't have her name specifically on the report, it mentions husband, wife, male, female, and it mentions that the male was a member of the National Guard, the Air National Guard, was at one point in time an active member of the Air Force, and the address, the location, the time frame, it all fits. Why? Because at that time, the address was known to be, he was known to have lived at that address. So even though we may not have the names on the report, we still have the locations. And all the other descriptors kind of fit what's going on there. So does this definitively prove that Grush had a psychological issue? Maybe, maybe not. One of the things that he brings up to defend his position is that he was struggling with PTSD. And this is something that a lot of service members have dealt with. Based on that information, let's kind of set aside the psychological thing. Now, based on the psychological, he should have lost his security clearance. But like I said, let's just set that aside. Maybe the powers that be said, you know what, dude's got some issues. He's trying to work these things out. Let's give him the benefit of the doubt. But you also go into it and you see that you can lose your clearance based on any type of substance abuse. So it's also his wife saying that he is an alcoholic. Which is grounds for his security clearance being revoked. But for some reason, unknown to us, it was not. So I could speculate at this point why it wasn't taken away, but that would just be me kind of throwing out a guess here. We really don't know, and maybe who knows. Somewhere in the future, more information will come out about that particular idea. Now, Grush will also mention that he resigned, or I'll do exact quote, I resigned on my own accord. Because I thought altruistically, it's more appropriate to show thought leadership on the outside of this now, because I know hidden in the past within the government, as I'm saying this correctly, to right this wrong. So Coulthard asks, take me through the process of how you convince yourself this is real. Grush responds, based on the credentialed people that came to me, some of these subjects provided me. Sensitive foreign intelligence read, scientific program documents to evaluate, and then described in very specific detail how all of this worked. then they were telling me the exact, extremely specific details that all checked out. So, issue, what evidence? Specify, dude. Who presented this evidence? And if you haven't seen it, how do you know it's real? For example, I'm at the museum the one day, and this woman from Long Island, and I was just stopping by to talk to Lance, and this woman was on the tour, and Lance introduced her to me. Thank you, Lance, by the way. That was like 40 minutes of my life I'm never getting back. She believed that she saw an alien and asked if I could debunk her experience. I told her it would be hard to debunk because I wasn't there and I had nothing to examine. But you know what? Love to hear your story. Her experience took place 30 years ago. It was at a beachside bar in Long Island, and this was just after sunset. She informed me that she had a beer, which she immediately corrected to, no, I think it was two beers. And I looked at her and said, anything else? And she responded, oh, you know what? I also smoked a little pot, but it was only one joint. I think at this point, I kind of figured out what was going on. But anyway, she said while she was sitting there, she heard a voice. But it wasn't out loud. It was in my head. When I looked up, I saw a man sitting at a table by himself. We were the only people there. He told me he wanted to give me a gift. I asked what the gift was. She said, it wasn't an actual gift. He showed me things. Like what, I asked? She said, he showed me the universe, and he told me not to fear death. That death is not the end, that it's just a transition. Since that time, I haven't been afraid of dying. When I asked why she thought he was an alien, she said, because he talked to me in my head. I asked about his appearance, if there was anything unusual, those types of things. She said, no, looked like a normal person. What's my point? Based on our conversation, I believe this woman had an experience, and I believe she was being honest about what she experienced. Do I believe she saw an alien? No. Why? Drugs, alcohol, they're definitely going to affect the lens through which you kind of filter everything. I believe she was definitely influenced by those things, and that affected how she interpreted her experience. How does this apply to Grush? Like the woman I spoke to, Grush has no physical evidence. He does a poor job of connecting the dots. And in the case of this woman, the only thing that she could come up with to back her claim that she believed this gentleman was an alien was the fact that he talked in my head. So I go back to, he doesn't do a very good job of connecting the dots, and he doesn't explain why he comes to the conclusion that it's either aliens or alien. This is reflected in his testimony during the UAP hearing in July of 23. Direct quote, my testimony is based on information I have been given by individuals with a long-standing track record of legitimacy and service to this country, many of whom shared compelling evidence in the form of photography, official documentation, and classified testimony. In the 2 years since the hearing, David Grush has pretty much disappeared from the UFO scene. Now, why? I'll come back to that in a few minutes. First, right after the interview aired and the hearing was held, visitors at the museum would ask me, what were my thoughts on both of those things? The majority of the time, they were hoping I would either confirm their suspicions that everything was true or that it was just a total hoax. My standard response was, only time will tell. I don't have enough information to make a well-informed decision. Back to why. When all of this originally occurred, it was tough to say if Grush was intentionally misleading people, if he was the typical head case that spouts nonsense, or was he himself being misled? Initially, I believed him to be misled. I still believe that to this day. Although he never mentions the insiders, I don't think it's hard to figure out the insiders that he's talking about. I think it's going to be the typical names that we're used to hearing. I just received an email the other day. We have, and that's what's great, we have this discussion within our investigator group of some of these different people. Like, who are these government people? Well, maybe Elizondo, maybe Hal Putoff, maybe some of these other guys who have held security clearances at one point in time. In any case, why would they mislead him? And then there's your others, the people with the podcast and that kind of thing. And I don't want to say any names because I'm afraid I'm going to get Joe in trouble here. If you do decide to come to the UFO festival and you want my full blown opinions, ask. I'll tell you. So this way Joe doesn't get in trouble. So I worded it this way. Just think about the attention that this draws to the topic, the eyes, the ears, that it draws to podcasts or to YouTube channels and the subscriptions, things like that. In the end, I believe that they, quote unquote, they, ufologists, used him as a means to bump up their clicks, their likes, and also to pad their wallets. Why do I say this? Maybe I'm wrong. I don't think so. Where's Gresh going? He's disappeared from the ufology scene. This is my opinion. I believe he disappeared, not because of government backlash. I think he finally figured out that he was being used and that he was being used to push a certain narrative. And once the ufologists got what they wanted, they cut him loose. Or maybe he came to the realization on his own that, you know what, I'm being used. And he decided to distance himself from them and the UFO topic. So to answer those people who wanted to know if Grush was a liar, no, I don't think he is. But I don't think he's giving accurate information either. Why? The Magenta crash was a fictional story made up by William P. Brophy. It was regurgitated and is still regurgitated by these ancient alien theorists and fringe ufologists. Why? To further their cause and, in the end, make more money because you don't grift the grift. The alien bodies can be seen with the Magenta crash, later on with Silas Newton and the Aztec crash. And you guys can look this stuff up. Newton and his partner, a gentleman by the name of Leo Gebauer, claim that they used exotic materials or alien materials that they found from the Aztec crash to create what is called the doodle bug. And this would help them locate like gold, oil, stuff like that. Their story is going to be published in Variety magazine. The reporter that writes the story is a gentleman by the name of Frank Scully. Frank included information about 16 humanoid bodies in the wreckage. Supposedly, they were from Venus. And I apologize, I'm going to do another little side note here. Just in case you didn't know, Venus happens to be one of the most inhospitable planets in our solar system. The atmosphere has sulfuric acid that will eat through basically anything. Any of the Voyager units that were sent to Venus, the longest lasting one was like an hour and a half. Some of them lasted 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. Here's what we know. Venus is incapable of sustaining life. So anything that is linked to Venus should automatically send up red flags and should be tossed immediately. Anyway, the article also gives rise to the idea of exotic materials. Now, Scully was given the materials, supposedly super light metals, and they had strange writing on them. That should sound really familiar to everybody. Why? What's the claim of Roswell? Anyway, so the samples will be given to Frank Scully. Scully will take those. He will have them examined. And as it turns out, it's aluminum. Shocking, isn't it? In regards to documents, there are precious few legitimate documents, let alone one that actually mentions alien bodies. The only document I know of is what they call the Guy Hotel memo. The document can actually be found on the FBI website. It is the most looked at and downloaded document on the government website. So this was written by Guy Hotel, FBI special agent, in March of 1950. He was located in the state of Washington, and the memo was addressed to the director of the FBI, who at the time was J. Edgar Hoover. Now, people be like, oh, wow, the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, it's got to be true. So what you need to know is that the FBI was actually tasked by the Air Force during the 1940s into the 1950s to look into some of these FBI cases. So the FBI actually kept tabs on UFO stories. And this was done up until 1950. So you can find a copy of the memo on the FBI.gov/records site. It's a one-page memo that mentions a recovered saucer in New Mexico. It mentions a small craft, only about 50 feet, which was occupied by three small humanoid bodies. The informant claims that the crash was caused by interference from a nearby radar installation in, you guessed it, New Mexico. There's no follow-up to the memo. Why? Because the information was from a third or a fourth party, not necessarily a first-hand source. The FBI believed it to be a repeat of the hoax of a hoax at that time, which had been circulating around. I'll kind of start getting into my conclusion here. It's amazing what people are going to believe. Now, I'm not privy to some of the things that Grush may have been able to see. I can imagine which in photos and in things that he had seen. Most likely, it's probably going to be the same photos that most of us have seen. You know, the standard Nazi Bell UFO photos, the McMinn photos, the Adamski photos, the Gulf Breeze photos, and what the hell, man, the Billy Meyer photos. And again, on the point of what people are willing to believe, I'm going to give you my own personal example, okay? So this is going back a few years ago, roughly about 3 years ago. I'm on a Zoom call with all of the New York State MUFON FIs. And we had a state director from a southern state, won't mention the name, and he was a guest speaker during our Zoom. This gentleman, he spoke about Nazi UFOs, talked about the Vril Society, and how right now we are engaged in an intergalactic fight on the edge of our solar system. He also claimed that he had photos that he had stored on his laptop, but when he went to retrieve them, they had suddenly disappeared. He had no reason why. Somebody must have gone on his laptop and they must have deleted that information from it. Anyway, so the intergalactic fight that we're in, supposedly we are involved with the Chinese and the Russians, and we are working together to fight off this threat. His comment was, direct quote, "We are friends in space, but for some reason, we can't get along down here." He also mentioned that the Navy has aircraft with cloaking technology, that the triangles people are seeing in the skies, and if you're wondering what triangles, you might remember a little video from a certain website that talked about these little green triangles that were floating around in the sky while these guys were using night vision goggles, which has thoroughly been debunked. Anyway, that these little triangles that people are seeing are an attempt to basically ease us into disclosure. And then for his grand finale, that the government is going to reveal very soon that we have a base on the moon, and that another whistleblower / insider has confirmed we have a base on Mars. Yes, you heard me correctly. Moon base and Mars base. This is a state director, folks. We're supposed to be impartial. We're supposed to be objective. We're supposed to provide evidence for claims. This is all based on the same thing that I'm talking about with Rush. This is all based on, well, he said, she said sort of stuff. We're supposed to weigh the evidence, then come to a conclusion. And it's unfounded bullshit like this that makes it harder for people to separate fact from fiction. Maybe that's what Crush's handlers' intentions were, that they wanted to kind of muddy the waters in an attempt to continue the grift and do so at our expense. Until next time, hopefully this leaves you in the right headspace.
Thank you, John. Yeah, David Grush is a very interesting guy. And do you guys believe him? Do you guys believe David Grush is telling the truth? Let me know. And yeah, give me a call at 845-600-0744. And if you have any paranormal experiences, please do the same. 845-600-0744. Or you can email me at ghostjoeny@gmail.com. You could do so anonymously. Please do so. I'd love to hear about it. And you could be featured on the show and win some cool prizes. So please definitely do that. Listen, I have a lot of great things coming up for you guys. There's a big, big change coming up soon. Starting June 20th, season 5, episode 1. Awesome change. You're going to love it. Definitely check it out. I have awesome shows coming up for you guys. I did a great interview with the Get Haunteds, Sarah and Rob. You're not going to want to miss that one. As well as psychic medium Chris Jansen, who's also going to be part of the show in season 5 as well. That's a little bit of a spoiler there for you. He's awesome. You're definitely going to love his stuff too. Definitely check out his interview when I air it as well. And I also have another interview coming up with Mr. Ken Mark. He's all right. He's all right. You might hear from that dude too, eventually. But he was a good guest too. He was good. We had a good time talking. So yeah, guys, great show coming up, and I'll see you next time. Later.
Thank you for listening to the Warp Reality Paranormal Podcast, and thank you to all of my guests and contributors that helped make this show possible. If you have a paranormal experience you'd like to share, questions, comments, or you'd like to be a guest in the show, please leave me a voicemail at 845-600-0744, or you can email me at ghostjoeny@gmail.com. You can do so anonymously if you'd like. Also, please check out our show notes for all social media links of this show and some of our friends. The Warp Reality Paranormal Podcast, uncovering the unseen.